back in my homeland. I'll be giving to you today a rapid fire tour through my lab, looking at actually just at my abstract. You should add tachyons at the bottom of the abstract and bugs, because I'm going to talk a little bit about water walking insects. Now, all this work has been done with undergraduates. The work on hydraulic jumps I've done in collaboration with Pekka Hosoi in mechanical engineering, and my grad student Brian Chan, David Hu, and a grad student in mechanical engineering. We looked at the water sliders. So, what do these problems have in common? Well, they're all dominated by surface tension. The approach is similar. We begin with experimental observations, which guide us in developing what we hope are appropriate physical pictures, and these in turn guide the development of our supporting theoretical models. So all of this work is motivated out of a fundamental interest, the question being what's going on. So we've seen really the thrown a number of geysers. Today we're going to see in a few more in my talk. So I just want to remind you, basically, we know that the jump in normal stress across an interface is proportional to the surface tension times the local curvature. So if we put a varicose instability on a cylindrical thread of fluid, then you get a high pressure region in the constriction. So it's high relative to that in the bulbous region. So flow is forced out of the constriction, and the perturbation is amplified, and this cylinder ultimately breaks up into a series of drops, which can be also understood in terms of energetics, because the surface area and therefore surface energy of a series of spheres is lower than that of a cylinder of the equivalent volume. Okay, and the details of the pinch-off depend on the Onnes-Flogger number, which is basically a Reynolds number based on the capillary wave speed. So in the limit where inertia is dominant, the most unstable wavelength is about 10 times the initial radius of the cylinder. As the Onnes order increases and so the influence of viscosity, the wavelength increases accordingly. So this first half of the talk is about a series of studies that grew out of exploratory investigation of sheets and jets. So this is something you can see in your kitchen sink. If you turn on your tap and you hold a spoon or a knife tip under the jet, then you'll generally create some sort of sheet. This is an irregular one. Here we have the knife tip. So it basically breaks up into, at its edge, by some sort of really plateau instability. If you do this in a controlled environment, so you have a perfectly circular impactor, then you'll get a circular sheet. So this, in terms of scale, the diameter of the impactor here is 1 centimeter. So fluid is coming out of here, hitting the impactor and being extruded radially. And it, so this class of problems was first considered by Savard and later by Taylor. Basically, the sheet goes to a radius at which the inertial force is balanced by the curvature force. Okay. So continuity requires that the sheet thin as you move from the point of impact. So it's scaled as 1 over r, r being the distance from the point of impact. Since the sheet speed is constant, so h is going as 1 over r. If we substitute h into this force balance of the rim, we get the Taylor radius. So the radius of the circular sheet increases with the flux within the sheet, the speed of the sheet, and decreases with surface tension. Okay, and so this proceeds until you hit this Taylor radius, and then you have a toroidal rim on the circular sheet, which breaks up via Rayleigh plateau, so via a capillary instability. So we wanted to see what the influence of viscosity was on the system. So this is our apparatus. It's very simple. We have a pump and flow meter going through our source nozzle and an impactor, and we can actually adjust this impactor so that we can change the angle of takeoff of the sheet. And so we're looking at viscosities in the range of 1 to 100 times that of water. So they're glycerin water solutions. And so with water, we get a circular sheet. When we increase the viscosity, it's about 10 times out of water, we've broken the symmetry and we get these polygonal fluid sheets. We can get any number of sides on the polygons. That was 7 to 6. We can also, so say, control the takeoff angle of the sheet, so generate fluid umbrellas or parasols. We get a parasol if we deflect it up. It turns the corner sharply and streams out of the corners. And here, we see all sorts of rich behavior here. We see capillary waves on the surface of the sheet. We see a polygonal sheet, and we see emerging from the corners of the sheet fluid chains. question, okay? And so this is basically the starting point of today's talk. So we want to basically be able to describe all of these shapes. Okay, so let's look at the chains to begin with. It's a simple geometry to examine. They can be generated in a much easier system. So if you basically have two jets colliding, so we have here, same pump, same flow meter. You have two nozzles. The nozzle diameter is about a millimeter. So you get this series of fluid chains. So basically, you have links in the chain. There's a thin film in between. You have the bounding rim, and you have mutually orthogonal links. Basically, the physical picture is the following. If you have two jets colliding, they give rise to a sheet in the plane perpendicular to the plane of incidence. This sheet develops rims which close through the influence of surface tension. So these rims then themselves become jets, and they collide. They give rise to a sheet in the plane perpendicular, and so on and so forth. Right? And so that goes on until it's killed by viscosity. And okay, so we want to be able to characterize this the shape of the sheet. The closest study to ours is that of Taylor, 1960. He looked at the same geometry, two colliding jets, but he was examining water sheets. So in this case, the water streams from the point of impact to the edge of the sheet, and then the sheet rims are unstable, so drops are ejected radially. And so you can calculate the sheet very simply if you know the flux distribution within the sheet, basically given by, again, this balance of inertia and curvature forces. So it's basically a Taylor radius. So as we draw it for the case of a circular sheet, the only difference here being that the flux distribution is a function of theta. Mm-hmm. So he had to actually stoop to calculating Q, the function of theta, as will we. One would think that you could calculate it, but it's not as easy as you might think. So, so things are different in our system, principally because in our system, the fluid hits the rim and then follows along the rim, so there is, it's moving on a curved path, so there's a centripetal force which is going to contribute to the normal force balance at the rim and therefore to the sheet shape. Okay, so let's look at the equations that govern the rim dynamics. We're looking at steady shapes, so the continuity requires that the gradient in flux along the rim be balanced by fluxing from the sheet. The normal force balance is written here. Again, the balance that gave us the Taylor radius was this one, just balancing the principal curvature force with the inertial force. There's an additional small curvature force associated with the curvature of the rim, but this is small. It scales as the relative magnitudes of the rim radius to the radius of curvature of the sheet. And there's this new term which is important. This is the centripetal force. This is the normal force associated with flow moving along a curved rim. We also have a tangential force balance, which has the gradient in tangential momentum flux along the rim has to be balanced by the gradient in curvature pressure, viscous resistance term. You can actually bend this because the Reynolds number is quite high, and we have tangential momentum flux in from the sheet as well. Okay, so these can be suitably non-dimensionalized, and you get a series of ODEs which, if appropriately initialized, can be integrated. But in order to initialize them, we have to know what the flux distribution within the sheet is. And as I said, it's not as easy to calculate as you might think, so we had to stoop to measuring it, as did Taylor. So basically what we did, very low tech, we just have a razor blade which sweeps across the sheet. We take a number of sweeps from which we can reconstruct the flux distribution within the sheet and use this to initialize our sheet shape integration. Okay. So these are some flux profiles. This is the cumulative flux. So this is the flux as a function of theta. You can see it's very peaked along the center line of the sheet. So if we use this to initialize our ODEs, we can get pretty reasonable agreement between experiments and theory. So these are three different sheets, and the theoretical predictions are overtopping yellow. So that's sort of the starting point to change. Now I want to get, so we started off with the polygonal sheets, and we saw chains coming out of the corners of the polygonal sheets, and now we see something emerging out of the chains. So now, exactly the same time, we have two jets colliding. This is the first link in the chain, so that's the first sheet. And we see along this edge, it's blurry. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen that for several weeks before we really started thinking about it. And then we turned a strobe onto it and found that it actually corresponds to this very regular and beautifully periodic structure. So when you strobe it, it hangs motionless in the air. In terms of length scale, so you can see this is a centimeter, so it's on the order of a centimeter between the these bulbous regions. So this is, so if we increase the flow rate a bit, the structure broadens, and again, if you strobe at the appropriate frequency, which is around 300 hertz, you see this elaborate structure. So this is a nice example of a Rayleigh Plateau pinch-off.
Thunderstream. That's
right. That's right. It's exactly the same. Yeah, you can, when you strobe it correctly, they're just hanging in the air. We didn't even take these with a high-speed film. We just shot them. In fact, many of them were multiple exposures. And so, what's going on here? These are we call these fluid fish bones for obvious reasons. So the fish head is this film. And the bones are these tendrils of fluid that are drawn up through the drop. So basically, we have flow along this rim. It's going unstable via capillary instability. So as it does so, you get these bulbous regions. These are flung out by the centripetal force as it tries to traverse the edge of the sheet. So they're flung out, and they drive with them tendrils of fluid, which then, in turn, break up the Rayleigh Plateau instability and give rise to this elaborate lake structure. And it can become as elaborate as you like and as colorful as you like. The joys of Photoshop, right? But here's some beads on the string. So here's a close-up. This is, again, you asked about the periodicity of it. These are multiple exposures, all of these. So there's three or four over like you see here. This one's getting a little bit random in the wake. So you can see that there are, in fact, there is superposition of a couple of images there. But here you see the pinch-off. The size of the drop even is precisely the same each time. Okay, so, right, video. So here we see the evolution is we have two jets colliding, we crank up the flow rate. So we go into the chain regime. Now as we crank it further, it gets blurry, and then if we turn the strobe on, we'll see the fish bones emerging. So again, for scale, this is around a centimeter. And by tuning the strobe, by changing its frequency slightly, you can, of course, advance or reverse time. Okay, so this is a very simple system, so you think that you should be able to characterize it readily enough. If we look at if we play the dimensional analysis game, we can identify that there are four dimensional groups. So we know this because there are seven physical variables, these being the jet radius, flux, density, surface tension, viscosity of the fluid, impact angle, and gravity. These can be expressed in terms of three fundamental units, so there have to be four dimensional groups. Choose impact angle, Reynolds number, Weber number, third number. The nice thing about this problem is that the third number is very large. And basically, the form of the structure produced by the impact of these jets is not dependent on gravity. So you can take your structure, and so we have jets. Well, you do experiments like this, but if you turn it on the side, you'll basically get fish bones or chains. They'll, of course, droop as they proceed from the point of impact. But basically, gravity is not important in setting the qualitative nature of the structure. So we can bin it. Once we've binned it, we've got three-dimensional parameter space, and we can fix the impact angle, and therefore characterize the system in a plane. So we do a parameter regime study sweeping through Reynolds number and Weber number space. And so that's what we do here. So this shows the dependence of all the structure you can get on from two colliding jets. And so as a function of Reynolds number and Weber number, so each of these traces corresponds to a flow of a particular viscosity, and as you increase the flux, one of these lines. So here we're spanning the viscosity range from 1, that's water, to about 100 times that of water. So this is, here we see the Taylor regime. This is where the sheet breaks up. It has unstable rims, so drops are ejected radially from the rims. As you increase the viscosity, the typical progression, as we saw in the video, goes from something which looks like an oscillating stream into a chain, then increase further, we go into the fishbone regime, and then out back into the chain regime. Then we go through this regime here where the sheet length exceeds the Taylor radius, so it basically gets cut off by surface tension at its base. And if you increase the flow rate further, you can go into this flapping regime. So here, basically, you're getting shear-driven instability of the sheet. This regime has been studied considerably owing to its relevance in a number of spray atomization processes. But what I want to point out is there are two distinct, qualitatively different mechanisms for instability of the sheet. One is this shear-driven instability, which you get at high flow rates, and one is this rim-driven instability, which is responsible for the fishbones. And these fishbones have not previously been observed. Okay, so all of these, that line of problems grew out of another kitchen sink experiment, which is the hydraulic jump. You've all seen this when you're doing your dishes. So you have a water jet hitting a plate, and basically you get a layer which thins until it reaches a critical radius at which it jumps. And so this is our experiment, same pump and flow meter. So we have an impacting plate, and we can control the depths of the ambient with the outer wall, which we can screw up and down as we like. So basically, Thomas Bohr and co-workers reported in a Nature paper in 1997 that when one increases the viscosity in the hydraulic jump, one gets symmetry breaking instability, which results in polygons. Mm-hmm. And so they looked at their jumps were about, this is the parameter regime they were considering, so the diameter of the jet is 1 centimeter, so you can see that the jump itself is a couple of centimeters, and the viscosity was 10 times that of water. So while they reported these, they did not propose a mechanism for instability. Moreover, they did not identify the importance of surface tension in the jump structure. And you expect, this is again 2 centimeters, that's precisely the sort of scale where you expect surface tension to come into play. And so what I want to do first is convince you that surface tension is indeed important in the jump structure. I'll do that by showing you this video. Okay, so there's a polygonal jump. It's wobbling a bit because it's hard to get the thing perfectly balanced. But the point is, it's pouring down. Now we've put in a drop of surfactant, so just a little bit of dishwashing soap. So all it does is bring down the surface tension, and you see two qualitative changes. The polygon reverts to a circle, and it also expands slightly in radius. Okay, so clearly surface tension is important. Okay, so let's first review the theory for a circular hydraulic jump. You basically get the radius of the jump from a momentum integral statement. So you balance the jump and radial momentum flux at the jump with the hydrostatic, with the force associated with integrating the hydrostatic head over the surface of the jump. So in the limit, in the inviscid limit, which is considered by Rayleigh, you can assume that the speed within the film is everywhere equal to that of the incident jet. So if you do this, you get a simple expression for the jump radius as a function of the outer depth, the incident jet radius, and the flux. So we aren't going to dwell on this because it's well known to be inadequate in describing jumps on this sort of laboratory scale. The reason for this is because viscosity comes into play. Basically, momentum is being pulled out of the film by the diffusion of vorticity from the lower plane. So the influence of viscosity on the circular hydraulic jump was considered by Watson in a beautiful paper, a JFM paper in 1964. So he described the flow in terms of a growing biaseous-type boundary layer. So it grows from the point of impact until it spans the entire fluid depth at a radius which is proportional to the Reynolds number to the 1/3. That's Reynolds number based on the incident flux. So basically, until that point, the speed, the surface speed is equal to that of the speed of the incident jet. Beyond that, the surface speed decreases as 1 over r cubed. And so he basically matched this biaseous-type boundary layer near the point of impact onto a similarity solution in the far field, and so deduced the velocity field everywhere, therefore the height of the layer everywhere, and therefore the jump radius. And so his prediction, and this is a leading order, this is an order one correction to the inviscid theory of Rayleigh, and it's been tested many times, probably a dozen experimental studies. And it does actually a very good job of describing the radius of jumps on a laboratory scale. It breaks down when the jumps become small. Okay, so when the jumps get sort of a couple of centimeters or smaller, things break down. And of course, this is exactly where you expect surface tension to come into play, and it's exactly the regime in which Bohr observed the polygons. So the first thing to do is to calculate the correction to Watson's theory, necessitated by consideration of the curvature force. So to calculate the curvature force on the jump, basically there's curvature in this direction on the jump, that gives rise to a radial force, in which we can calculate. We just have to integrate the curvature pressure, which is sigma div n, and take its radial component, integrate it around the surface, so we can parameterize the surface as z equals h of r, so write its normal, divergence of the normal, and this is the surface element we integrate around, and we get the total radial curvature force associated with surface tension. We can see that it's proportional to the surface tension and this geometric factor. So this geometric factor is arc length, so S is arc length, and delta R is the radial distance between these points A and B. These are the points nearest the jump, upstream and downstream of the jump, at which the slope vanishes identically. Okay, so it's an exact result for the curvature force, and you can check it in the limits. It makes sense in the limit of a flat interface, the curvature force, this curvature correction vanishes. For a sudden jump, it gives what you would expect for a circular cylindrical annulus. Okay, so this basically gives a correction to Watson's prediction for the jump radius of order, it's basically going to be of order surface tension to gravity. So it's proportional to 1 over the Baum number. We see it these terms underlined here, so you have this messy expression. But we've looked to see how important this is, and it's not that important. It's about order for these small jumps. It becomes important as large as 30%, but typically 10% if your jump is around a couple centimeters in radius. So in the regime that Bohr examined, the net radius changes a little bit owing to surface tension, but we can see that surface tension is playing a dominant role in terms of the shape of the jump. So it's actually I'm going to argue that it's responsible for the symmetry breaking. Okay, so let's review what Bohr did. So he discovered these polygonal jumps, and he described their dependence on the flow rate Q and the height of the nozzle above the plane of incidence. So he didn't characterize the system in terms of its dimensionless, governing dimensionless groups, and did not provide a mechanistic explanation. So the first thing we'd like to do is eliminate the source conditions. We'd like to describe the system in terms of the speed and radius of the jet at the point of impact rather than at the source, so we can relate the two very simply through Bernoulli. And then we have the following system, which we can again play our dimensional analysis game with. So we have now 7 physical variables in terms of 3 fundamental units. So again, we have 4 dimensionless groups. We again have Reynolds number, Weber number. Here we have Baum number, which is gravity to surface tension. We also have a length ratio, so this is the ratio of the outer deck to the incident jet radius. So unfortunately, we are not in a limit where any of these is negligible, so we have a 4-dimensional parameter space to scan through. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at this 3-dimensional parameter space for a number of fixed values of B. So you see that the Baum number depends only on the radius of the incident jet, so we can control that easily and then do a couple of 3D parameter scans. So let's just describe what we see. As we increase the outer layer depth, one goes through this progression. This is for the case of circular jumps. So initially, the surface flow is everywhere radially outwards. As the outer depth increases, you get this separation, so you get a stagnation point at the free surface, and this vortex adjoining the jump. As you increase the outer depth further, you get this tiered structure in the jump. Okay, so these are some structures we saw in our lab. So we see triangles, squares, pentagons, and basically any kind of gons you'd like to see. And then we see this, we have this new class of shapes which Bohr didn't observe. And basically, just by changing the nozzle radius, you get these what we call clovers. So this is a cacti, tulip clover 3 and 4. And you see these are actually marked by this tiered structure. This is glycerin water. So all with viscosities between 1 and 100 times water. Okay, so again, we're going to fix the problem number by fixing the radius of the incident jet and then scan through a three-dimensional planar space. So doing so, you can see basically the dependence. So you're basically characterizing the system. So we have turbulence, clovers in red, polygons in yellow, type one in green, blue, type two, and no jump here. So you can basically see things are, so these three planes through the three-dimensional parameter space, these four planes correspond to different fluid viscosities. So let's zoom in on this one. This is actually very close to the regime that Bohr considered. So let's take a 2D slice, or Reynolds number, Weber number. Each of these traces corresponds to a fixed outer depth, and as we move along here, we're increasing the outer depth. So, and as you move along here, you're increasing the flux. So as you increase the outer depth, you go from type 1 to type 2. And the type 2 jump, it's always, the type 1 jump's never gone stable to polygons, it's always type 2. So you always have this vortex adjoining the jump if you want to get the instability. So as we, again, increase the outer depth and we go through this polygon regime, again, you can see that they fall out in well-defined regions of parameter space, and then if you increase the outer depth too much, the jump disappears.
How do you make the observation of the recirculation?
Right, so you can get you can put in little microbubbles in the source, and you can see them spiraling around, or any sort of impurity. Okay, so this is just empirical, but again, so now we can look at a different bond number, which corresponds to a different nozzle radius, and again, you get a 3D parameter space. Here, we're going to look at this plane here. This corresponds to viscosity of 32 centistokes. Here you can see that this clover regime is quite prevalent. So again, as we increase the outer depth, we go from type 1 to type 2, and then into these peculiar clover-type structures, and then the jump eventually vanishes. Okay, so that's just empirical. What's the physical picture? Why is this thing going unstable? Everything I told you today has hinged on the Rayleigh-Pateau instability, so there's no point in changing my story now. So basically I'm saying that this instability of the jump is a capillary instability of the jump surface, which we view as the inner portion of a torus. Right? So we've seen capillary instability on a cylindrical thread, and we've seen it on a toroidal rim of a sheet, and we've seen it on the edge of a fishbone. Now we're seeing it along the surface of a torus, which is a hydraulic jump. Okay, so that being the case, we should be able to get a scaling for the wavelength. Basically, in these capillary columns, the wavelength of instability is going to be, we expect to be proportional to the radius of curvature of the jump. Okay, now, so we have to get a scaling for that. We know that we only get these polygonal instabilities when there's a vortex adjoining the jump, which is very handy. So we have this vortex swirling here, so we can assess the Reynolds number characterizing this vortex, and it's high. So we know that the physical balance along the jump surface is between inertia and curvature forces. Okay. So that gives us a scaling for the radius of curvature of the jump, and we expect the wavelength to scale as this radius of curvature. So we expect the wavelength to scale at sigma over rho u squared, where u is the speed in the vortex. And we can calculate that this is basically equivalent to the speed at the base of the jump, which we can calculate from Watson's viscous theory. Okay, so this is it's just a scaling, and this is a bit of a scatter plot, I'll admit, but it could be worse. So this is the wavelength of instability non-dimensionalized by the outer layer. Yes, and this is for all shapes, right? So this is for all of the polygons, all of the clovers. So it's a mess, and there's all sorts of physics going on which we've binned, but you can see it's on the same page. And basically, I mean, the basic story is that surface tension is important. Okay, so to conclude this portion of the talk, so it's sort of an interesting story because we again started with these with Bohr's observations of polygonal junction. That inspired us to go looking for polygons in the sheets, and we found them. And then we found emerging from the corners of the polygonal sheets chains, and from the chains we found emerging fishbone. And we went back to the jumps. But in terms of, and we, so we basically just extended some work of Taylor on the rim sheet dynamics in order to characterize the shapes of sheets bound by stable rims. And in terms of physical picture, we've just seen Rayleigh plateau in a number of geometries. So we saw it on a cylindrical head, we saw it along the torus, which joined the circular sheet, and we saw it along the jump, which we view as the inner portion of the torus. And for the fish bones, we basically have its pinch off of the rim bounding a sheet, but the flow, they're slow along the rim, so as it develops, the tendrils are flung outwards. But they're all basically Rayleigh plateau instability. Okay, good. I've got 10 minutes of water sliders for your viewing pleasure. So this is what I'm excited. So that's the end of that story. And this is a completely different one, but it's a new one. I'm quite excited about it. So these are water sliders. They're about this big. You probably see them scooting around ponds. They weigh 1 dyne, which is 1 to 10 dyne. So that's 1 to 10 milligrams. Their contact leg length is around 1 centimeter. Their perimeter is about 5 centimeters. And if you recall, the surface tension of air water is 70 dynes per centimeter. If they punch through the free surface, they have to generate about 100 times their weight to get back through. So this is an undertaking which they try to avoid. And they, in order to avoid doing so, they have very hairy legs, which makes them effectively non-wetting. So there are two ways of walking on water. If you're sufficiently, so this is a bachelor's lizard, which is about this big, and they run along the free surface. They basically, they're so large that they can't depend on surface tension, so they have to slap the free surface. There's a reaction force which keeps them afloat. And then we have the smaller creatures, which we'll be, I'll be talking a little bit about today, which basically deflect the free surface, and so it behaves somewhat like a trampoline to generate a normal force which bears its weight. Okay, so I found that there are some, the dynamics of these creatures was poorly understood, so we went and got some in Walden Pond and looked at them with high-speed videos and applied standard methods of fluid dynamics to try and sort out what was going on. So here's one. So you can see they can either glide along the free surface or they can leap. But again, they're sort of exploiting the trampoline-like behavior of the free surface. Here we see one taking off like a rocket, in case you missed it. And here's and here's one jumping vertically. And they never break through the free surface. Okay? And here's where I just like this water strider, combat courtship. Walking that fine line between the two. And those are two males walking in, so to speak. And this is a female. She seems more interested in the snack. She's eating a fruit fly. But we'll watch them strut afterwards. That's what I really like. Okay, so that's your first introduction to water strider combat. So what do we learn from that? I have actually censored this talk. Yeah. So what do we learn from looking at these guys? Well, the peak speed is on the order of a meter per second. We can get there, calculate their momentum easily enough. The Reynolds number characterizing their stroke is large. And the propulsive force is about 50 dynes. And you can deduce this by either looking at their acceleration or their leap height. And it's an interesting number because it's basically, given that their leg length is about a centimeter, it's the maximal force that they can apply without breaking through the free surface. So they are, in some sense, ideally tuned to life at the free surface, as you would expect if they've been evolving for 100 million years. So now we get to the problem. The problem is how these things transfer momentum. So basically, in order for these things to move, they have to transfer momentum backwards. Right? So they have to impart some momentum to the underlying fluid, and this allows them to move forward. Okay, so it's previously been assumed, if you look casually at a water strider on a sunny day, you'll see ripples in its wake, propagating backwards, as we see here. And so it was previously assumed that this was the mechanism by which they transfer momentum to the underlying fluid. Okay, so this led to Denny's paradox, which says that infant water striders can't swim. This is in the same vein as the paradox which says that bumblebees can't fly. It simply points out a shortcoming in our understanding of a biological system. So, as he says, exactly how they manage to propel themselves across the water surface remains a mystery. So the reasoning that leads to this paradox, there are three assumptions. It turns out all of them are wrong or flawed. But the first one, I've mentioned, they've assumed previously that the only way that the water strider can transfer momentum to the underlying fluid is through capillary waves. And they also assumed that in order for the insects to generate waves, their leg speed must exceed this minimum wave speed, 23 centimeters per second. This is true with the system if you have something moving steadily at the free surface but not accelerating. So that's actually wrong as well. And they also assumed that the infant leg speed is always less than this minimum wave speed. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. So we'll give them a break there. But the assumption that I want to question is this one. So basically, again, they assume the infant water strider, they say, cannot move its leg fast enough to generate capillary waves. Therefore, it can't transfer momentum to the underlying fluid, and therefore it can't move. And so here we have a one-hour-old infant water strider. We bred them in captivity, and so they swim to the top, punch through, and you can see he is unconstrained by Denny's paradox. Zips along the free surface like you've never read about it. And how do we resolve this? Well, there are, of course, other means by which you can transfer momentum to a fluid if you're sitting on the free surface, and here we'll see how they do it. So this is an adult water strider. I should explain, this is basically a wall of dye. So we have white fluid here, clear fluid here. As he strokes his leg, you see that he generates these dipole pairs, okay, which transfer momentum backwards. So we can also characterize the flow in the wake via particle tracking, and then we can do arc shots, gratuitous arc shots. So this is Marangoni convection generated by sprinkling thymol blue on the surface, so it gives rise to this paintbrush-like texture, which is then wrapped up by the vortical structures of the water strider. And so here we have an infant water strider, and it's vortical wake, and this is our shot at Monet. This is walking on clouds, so again you see the pair of vortices. As much as I like Monet, I prefer Van Gogh, and so here we have Icarus. So here, again we see this paintbrush-type texture generated by the fine Marangoni convection. Here we see a chunk of thermal blue. Thermal blue decreases the surface tension, so you get surface divergence, which sweeps the dye away. And we're lighting from below, so the light comes up through this bare spot, and these guys are light-seeking. And so that's how you can get them to move around in the water with a flashlight. So they go towards the sunspots, and thus we get Icarus. And we were very happy that this appeared on the cover of Nature in August. And so the physical picture that comes out of this is that they're basically can transfer momentum in one of two manners. One is through capillaries and one is through vortices. And so it's very easy to assess which is dominant, and I'll just give you the answer. The vortices win hands down, so the momentum in the vortices is comparable to that of the strider and much greater than that in the waves. Okay, so basically we resolved Denny's paradox by showing that the momentum transfer is principally in the form of vortices rather than waves. So basically these guys are rowing, but they're rowing without breaking the free surface. So they're basically deflecting the free surface downwards and using the meniscus that they generate in so doing as the blade on their oar.
The mechanism is
viscosity? No, it's high Reynolds number, so they're just depressing the free surface, and they're not pushing hard enough to break through the free surface. They deform and then sweep backwards. So you basically have a dimple, which they're using as the blade on their oar.
Of course, their feet are not very big, so we have to
go
rapidly.
That's right, but the Reynolds number is high. The Reynolds number is several hundred. Yeah.
That's one interesting message that increases in the water development in Brazil.
Right, but I want to say there's an interesting question of nomenclature, because the water boatmen, well, water boatmen in Canada, anyways, swim below the surface. In England, they do seem to call them water boatmen. But in any case, so there's been a lot of work done on, of course, flying birds and swimming fish. This is from an article, Michael Dickinson's article in News and Views about our article. And so our study basically puts the motion of these water walking insects in context. You see basically how it transfers momentum, so the vertical patterns which it produces, and how it is that it moves. So, right, so we wanted to build the first mechanical water walker. So we want to learn apply what we learned about their real water strider to guide us in developing RoboStrider. And so we know that he had to have non-wetting legs, so we used stainless steel wire, which was suitably coated. We knew that it had to be light enough to be supported by surface tension, so it weighed a third of a gram, and the force per unit length for the grabbing leg has to be less than twice surface tension, or it'll punch through. And we wanted something that looked like a real water strider. So here he is facing his beleaguered natural counterpart. and we see So basically, there's an elastic thread here, which we spring load, and we have a pulley here, which drives its central pair of legs. So these are just for support. These ones actually move, as we'll see in a second. So it slaps the surface and moves without breaking through. And it looks very professional if you have an engineering student who can draw these sorts of things. So it says lightweight aluminum chassis, which was in fact a 7-Up tin, and an elastic thread, which was taken from my student's sock. So this experiment is not on a shoestring, but a sock string. And here you see him in action. So he just releases the spring-loaded pulley, and the shoulders flap, and it moves along without breaking through. If you're lucky, sometimes. Right, and so that actually, despite it costing nothing, made it into the pages of The Economist, which we were very excited. It was clearly comic relief, but because the other article in the science section was on AIDS in Africa, so that was just a bit of a joke by comparison. So so there are other modes of surface locomotion, which I'll show you a couple of them. So basically everything you can imagine in nature exists. There's Marangoni propulsion, there are these guys that eject surfactant. You've probably seen the demo where you take a toothpick and you put soap on the end, you put it down, there's an unbalanced surface stress which pulls it in the away from the soap. And here we'll see an insect doing just that. So we put twilight or lycopodium powder on the surface so you can see how the surface film evolves, but again it just releases the surfactant and the surface tension gradient pulls it along. They can also generate non-zero forces by detracting the free surface fore and aft. So here we see this it looks like something out of Matrix. So he's trying to climb a meniscus, and that's how he does it. And then we have these guys. So how do you climb a meniscus if you're very small relative to the capillary length? This is the last thing I'll show you. If you're small relative to the capillary length, this looks like a frictionless mountain. So this is how they do it. We'll see one in action. He tried scampering up the meniscus but couldn't make it, but now he's going to lock his legs into a position which allow him to ascend the meniscus in a static position. Okay, so what's he basically doing? He's basically exploiting the Coulomb-like attraction between menisci. If the menisci have a leg sign, they're attractive, so he pulls up with his front legs. This generates a force which pulls him upwards. He has to balance torque, so he's going to flip, so he has to pull up on his back legs, so there's a torque balance. But he also has to balance his weight with the total surface tension force generated by forming free surface, so he has to push down with his middle legs. So, and you can actually calculate optimal leg configurations, which we've done, but I don't have time to share it with you, so I'll just show you another video of this guy in action. And you can see that he's doing this here. We're lighting from above, so the meniscus will cast shadows. When he pulls up, you get a bright spot, and when he pushes down, you get a dark spot. Because you're lighting from above, so The light will be focused if you have an upwards dimple and will be diffused if you push downwards. So, so the way this goes is my student goes into the swamp and brings back insects, and we look at them and we go, what on earth is going on here? And so then we go into the biology literature and we find that that we aren't mad when we see what we're seeing, but they actually describe it. But there's no consideration of mechanism, forces, or energies in describing their motion. So I'm quite excited about this area. But this one's slightly different because this we found first in the biology book, and we said this has to be wrong. So basically, it seems that this guy is climbing its own meniscus. Okay, so it pushes down with its nose and tail and pulls up on the free surface. It has this mouth on its belly and shoots along the free surface in a static position. So it seems to be violating some fundamental, if not all fundamental, principles of mechanics. But, so we didn't believe that. We said, that's got to be wrong. And so until my student brought one back from the swamp, and here we'll see him in action, gliding along the free surface without moving. So, what's going on? I will end it there and welcome any questions.
So, this is the centrifugal acceleration of setting up the system?
Yeah. Yep. So the capillary instability is basically prompting the instability, then it's being amplified, and the fish bones are being flung out by the centripetal force associated with the motion along the curved end.
It looks like there's some sort of instability.
Yeah, right. So exactly. So we looked at that. We were trying to figure out whether it was waves or whether it was wave driven or rim driven. And you'll notice to begin with in that parameter regime diagram, there's the regime at very high speeds where you get shear-driven instability, and this is in a much lower region. And also, if you look at the linear theory for the flapping modes, the wavelengths are way off, and the growth rates are way off. So it is definitely capillary instability here. Yeah?
So with the Mirabuini swimmer, if you pull the same trick you pulled earlier and put it back into the water, is that
Yeah, he'd be in all sorts of trouble. In fact, these guys, they don't like soap at all because it changes the wetting properties of their legs and they typically fall through. You can fish them out and hose them down.
Yeah. As far as this stroke pictures are concerned, naively one would have thought that the exact locations of the branches would be affected by noise and the input.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we actually we were actually concerned that these structures might be forced by some noise in the pump or something, and so we actually took a bucket and put it up on the ceiling, and so we did a gravity feed, and we got exactly the same thing. So it's definitely not. You can generate if you have a stable chain and you shake it, then you can get instabilities. But our system is unforced. Yeah. And we took great care to make sure that it wasn't.
If you get some reflow from the heat shock event, which is pretty violent, so that's supposed to generate some capillary
leakage and propagate upstream. Well, I mean, the waves, these things are moving at about a meter per second, so the capillary wave speed is much less than that. So it's wildly supercritical.
Who's
that then? What is it? High rounds then?
Very
high. Okay. Yeah. Extrusion of a polymer? Just a cylindrical jet? Okay, I don't. Okay, I mean, you can imagine if you do put in non-Newtonian fluid, you're going to change the structure of the fishbone. In particular, you expect to be able to get very broad fish bones and suppress this capillary instability of the bones.
The reason why the polygon is happening in the type 2 is because you want low speed, you want that's the foundation point
there? Yeah, well, it's a good question. I think actually what it is, I think because there's a vortex, the curvature of the jump is actually greater. Right? So you have more surface energy, and so it's more likely to go unstable. It's a bit of a hand wave, but I'm not sure exactly, but I think that might contribute. Yep. No, keep tuned in, and I'll let you know the next APS.
Any more questions? Thanks, John.